From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Wizard of Oz returned to theaters today, digitally restored and remastered on the eve of its 60th anniversary. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, Algene Harmetz discusses her book, The Making of The Wizard of Oz. Theater critic John Lahr talks about his father, Bert Lahr, who played the Cowardly Lion, and Lorna Luft talks about her mother, Judy Garland. Then Lord Schwartz reviews a new Judy Garland box set. Later, we have a review of the new movie, Velvet Goldmine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Republican Congressman Steve Largen has decided to challenge House Majority Leader Dick Armey for his position. Largen says the GOP struck an iceberg in Tuesday's elections, and it's time to change the Titanic's crew. Largen says he also expects House Speaker Newt Gingrich to be challenged for his leadership position and by more than one Republican. But Largent would not tell who those challengers might be. Meanwhile, Representative Bob Livingston of Louisiana has called a news conference in a couple of hours. Livingston is seen as a potential Gingrich rival. Israeli authorities say two suspected car bombers were the ones killed in today's blast in Jerusalem. The bombing occurred at an outdoor marketplace, injuring at least 21 other people. The Islamic militant group Hamas has claimed responsibility for the attack. This prompted the Israeli cabinet to suspend debate on implementing the latest Middle East peace agreement. Reporter Joshua Brilliant is in Jerusalem.
The whole process is sort of stopped in the tracks now, and they say they'll resume the deliberations only after the Palestinians crack down on terror, undertake to amend the Palestinian covenant or charter in a vote. They're referring there to the clauses that don't recognize Israel's right to exist. So once the Palestinians meet these conditions, according to the cabinet announcement, then Israel will reconvene the cabinet to ratify the agreement.
Reporter Joshua Brilliant in Jerusalem. Spain is increasing pressure on Britain to send former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet to Madrid to face trial on charges of crimes against humanity. Spain's government has formally approved an extradition request that will be sent to London shortly. Giles Tremlett reports from Madrid.
The conservative Spanish government of Prime Minister José María Aznar has stood by its pledge not to block attempts to try Chile's General Augusto Pinochet in a Madrid courthouse. Aznar's cabinet has today formally approved an extradition request which calls on Britain to send the former military strongman to Spain to face charges of genocide, terrorism and torture. The extradition request will be meaningless if Britain's House of Lords next week upholds an appeal court decision recognizing Pinochet's right to diplomatic immunity. But if the House of Lords overturns the decision, only the British government will be able to prevent the 82-year-old former dictator being extradited to Spain and imprisoned to await trial. For NPR News, I'm Giles Tremlett in Madrid.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 30 points at 8,945. Trading's active on volume of 315 million shares. The Nasdaq is up nearly 6 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, after a big run-up yesterday, stocks continue to gain ground at the end of the trading week. NPR's Jack Spear has this live report.
The last time the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up above 9,000 was back in July. That was July the 17th, when the market set its all-time closing high of slightly more than 9,300. Now it looks like blue-chip stocks may be heading in that direction again. Stocks gained ground yesterday on positive comments from Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan. And the market continues to move higher today. Investors are waiting on the latest data on consumer borrowing for the month of September. Barnes & Noble, meanwhile, says it's buying a book distributor, Ingram, for $600 million in cash and stock. Unilever, the world's biggest consumer goods maker, whose brands include Lipton Tea, says third-quarter profits rose 6%. And Japanese car company Mitsubishi says it lost money for the first half of the year. The company announced it's cutting several thousand jobs, including 1,000 in the U.S. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Union leaders at Federal Express have had a change of plans. A spokesman for the FedEx Pilots Association says they have delayed asking members for strike authorization votes. Ballots that were to have gone out yesterday will be sent out Monday to give contract talks more time. Chrysler expects its merger with Daimler-Benz to close on November 12th. Chrysler shares will continue to trade on the New York Stock Exchange through close of business that day. Trading of Daimler-Chrysler ordinary shares on a when-issued basis is expected to continue through November 16th. Regular way trading is scheduled to begin the next day. Chrysler will be dropped from the S&P 500. It is going to be replaced by Safeway Incorporated. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, The Wizard of Oz returns to the large screen for its first significant theatrical release in 25 years. This 1939 classic has been digitally restored and remastered in Dolby Digital Stereo. On today's archive edition, we have a collection of interviews about the film and its stars, and we'll hear music demos and outtakes from the film. Here's the composers of the score, Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're out of the woods, you're out of the dark, you're out of the night. Step into the sun, step into the light.
Can't you see the sign? Ring.
That's all, folks.
You're out of the woods, you're out of the dark, you're out of the night. Step into the sun, step into the light. Keep straight ahead for the most glorious place on the face of the earth or the sky.
That second version featured the performers from the film. Al Jean Harmetz, former Hollywood reporter for the New York Times, is the author of The Making of The Wizard of Oz. A new edition of this 1977 book is about to be published. I spoke with her in 1989 and asked her how Margaret Hamilton's Wicked Witch was made to look so creepy.
Margaret Hamilton actually had a green makeup with a copper base. And unlike Haley and Bolger and Lahr, she didn't have terrible prosthetics. Bolger, for instance, had a mask over his entire face. Lahr had a mask which showed only a bit of chin and his eyes, and once it was on, he couldn't eat, so he had to sip his lunch. Margaret Hamilton didn't have that problem, but she was immobilized by the fact that she was coated. Her hands, her face, her arms were all coated with this green paint, and she couldn't do anything for herself. As she said, that included the amenities in the bathroom. Her rubber pieces on her face, it did take a fairly long time. It took a couple of hours each day. The worst part was this terribly ugly wart, and it had sort of large black hairs protruding from it. And Margaret Hamilton was never a very attractive woman, except on the inside, where she was utterly lovely. But in terms of her look, she was a homely woman, even at the age of 30. And so I think she got more embarrassed and more unhappy than most people would out of being made uglier.
There's a great scene. This is just when Dorothy has arrived in Oz, and her house has killed the Wicked Witch of the East. The Good Witch gives Dorothy the ruby slippers, and the Wicked Witch of the West wants to take those slippers for herself. I wanted to play a clip from that scene.
Give me back my slippers. I'm the only one that knows how to use them. They're no use to you. Give them back to me. Give them back.
Keep tight inside of them. Their magic must be very powerful, or she wouldn't want them so badly.
You stay out of this, Glinda, or I'll fix you as well.
Oh, rubbish. You have no power here. Be gone before somebody drops a house on you.
Very well. I'll bide my time. And as for you, my fine lady, it's true, I can't attend you here and now as I'd like. But just try to stay out of my way. Just try. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Well, in that explosion, that's the explosion where the Wicked Witch of the West disappears in red smoke and fire. What actually happened during one of the takes of that was that Margaret Hamilton caught on fire. Can you describe what went wrong?
Yes. They had done it before lunch, and they had gotten one take, but the director, Victor Fleming, wanted more for insurance. And as Margaret Hamilton described it to me, what she did was she came back from lunch and everybody was a little loggy and they weren't really going very quickly. They were sort of too full. And four or five times things went wrong. The smoke didn't come up. She didn't disappear properly. And finally, Victor Fleming, who was very much of a Tartar, got extremely angry and he said, as soon as she gets her foot on top of that piece of yellow brick road, I want you to, well, she was to stand on a square of the yellow brick road, which was in actuality a hydraulic lift, an elevator which would take her underneath the stage. And she raised her hand and she said rather timidly, both feet, please, Mr. Fleming. She was not afraid of being burned. It had never occurred to her. She was afraid of breaking her leg. If both of her feet were not properly on that small square of yellow brick road and she had to back up to get on it, she was not walking to it, she was walking backwards to it, she was very much afraid that she would break a leg. So the next time they did the shot, the smoke and the fire came up, she disappeared underneath the stage and she felt a slight sensation of warmth. But when she got underneath the stage, the two stagehands who were stationed there to help her off ran at her, grabbed her broom, grabbed her hat off of her head, and she suddenly realized that her broom had caught fire. The broomstick part had been, the straw part had been right underneath her chin. The whole right side of her face was burned, her right eyebrow was burned off, and her right hand was badly burned. She went home, and she was not needed again for 6 weeks, which was lucky for her because of the fact that MGM would simply have replaced her. They didn't have to because she had the time to recover. But in the rest of the movie, she had to wear a green glove on the right hand because it did not allow itself to have grease paint or even to be touched after that.
Now, why didn't she sue them?
You didn't sue the studios in those days. As she said to me, if I had threatened to sue them, you know, I'd never have worked again. As a matter of fact, she told me about a conversation she had, which she found very queer, where somebody from the studio called her up, and after the conversation was over, she realized that they must have had a secretary on the line taking notes, because the fellow was saying things, well, you're not really hurt, are you? And she had the presence of mind to say, well, yes, of course I am. But she didn't sue them because she wanted to work in Hollywood again.
This film was really a vehicle for Judy Garland. However, we almost got to see Shirley Temple in the lead. Who wanted Shirley Temple to play the role?
The money men in New York. The creative people connected with the movie, Arthur Freed and Mervyn LeRoy, wanted Judy Garland from the very beginning. Actually, Arthur Freed was one of the people who was a Judy Garland backer at MGM. He was a young songwriter, a young assistant producer. In the 40s and 50s, he would make the greatest musicals at the studio that made the greatest musicals in that golden age of musicals. He would make Meet Me in St. Louis. He would win the Academy Award for American in Paris. In those days, he was just a young, ambitious man, and he had helped bring Judy Garland to the studio. He had sponsored her there. She had come 3 years earlier as a girl of 13, and he saw her as the only person to play Dorothy. Unfortunately, the money men in New York wanted box office insurance. And what better box office insurance than Shirley Temple? She'd been the top box office star in America in 1935, 1936, and 1937. MGM's Clark Gable had been a distant second to Shirley Temple. So L.B. Mayer tried to borrow Shirley Temple from 20th Century Fox. If he had succeeded, she would have played in the movie, no matter what the creative people wanted. Luckily, Daryl F. Zanuck did not loan her out.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine Shirley Temple singing a song with the musical range and emotional depth of Over the Rainbow. But speaking of Over the Rainbow, that song was actually almost removed from the movie.
Yes, it was. It was after the film was completed. They used to preview pictures by taking a private car and putting it on the red trolley line and taking it out to one of the outlying districts. In the case of The Wizard of Oz, it went down to San Bernardino, about an hour and a half away from Los Angeles. Usually a lot of the producers on the lot would go along. And after the movie was over, they came to Mayer and they said, "No MGM star can sing in a barnyard." Now, Mervyn LeRoy, the producer of the movie, said to me years and years and years later that he thought that they were jealous and that's why they wanted the song removed. I don't know if they were jealous or if they really thought it was beneath the dignity of an MGM star to sing in a barnyard, but indeed, Mayer took it out, took the song out of the movie, and it was Arthur Freed, along with the lyricist E.Y. Harburg, who shouted and screamed and begged and got Mayer eventually to put it back in again. And then, of course, Over the Rainbow won one of the two Academy Awards that The Wizard of Oz won in 1939. It lost almost everything else to Gone with the Wind, but it defeated Gone with the Wind in terms of the original score.
Because the lyricist E.Y. Harburg edited part of the script for the movie and also wrote some of the sequences himself, he was able to write the lead-in into the songs. And I think that was a liberty afforded few songwriters who really lost control of their songs once the movie was being made. He wrote the spoken passage into Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And you write a little bit about that in the book.
Yes. What was very special about the movie was that it was one of the very few times in the 30s when the songs in a movie actually advanced the plot. Most places, the songs were sort of like raisins dropped into a plum pudding. They were sort of nice to have, but if you'd taken them out, the whole thing would have been exactly the same. Harburg and Arlen were able to do it on The Wizard of Oz. They were able to make each of the songs. For instance, Over the Rainbow. Over the Rainbow definitely was the heart of the movie because it was the yearning of Dorothy to get away someplace where she wouldn't have any troubles. And so it told you in song exactly what was going to happen and where she was going to find herself.
Let me play this transition from the dialogue into the song of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I believe this transition was written by the lyricist E.Y. Harburg, yes?
Yes, he was able to do that.
Okay, here we go.
Annie, really? You know what Miss Gus said she was going to do to Toto? She says she
now,
was going to...
Now, Dorothy, dear, stop imagining things. You always get yourself into a fret over nothing. Now, you just help us out today and find yourself a place where you won't get into any trouble.
Place where there isn't any trouble. Do you suppose there is such a place, Toto? There must be. It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon, beyond the rain.
Heard of once in a lullaby.
We'll talk more about the making of The Wizard of Oz after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with Al Jean Harmetz. Her book, The Making of the Wizard of Oz, has lots of stories about who was almost in the film. For example, Buddy Ebsen, who later starred in the Beverly Hillbillies, was originally cast as the Tin Man. Here's Ebsen's version of If I Only Had a Heart.
When a man's an empty kettle, he should be on his mettle, and yet I'm torn apart. Just because I'm presuming that I could be kind of human if I only had a heart. I'd be tender, I'd be gentle, and awful sentimental concerning love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy that shoots the arrows if I only had a heart. Picture me, a balcony, above a voice sings low.
Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
I hear a beat. How sweet just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I would stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart.
Let's get back to our 1989 interview with Al Jean Harmetz.
I always like to imagine how movies would look if all the original actors that were supposed to be cast in it ended up in the final production. We had talked about how Shirley Temple was almost cast in the Judy Garland part. And Buddy Ebsen was originally cast in the role of the Tin Man.
Actually, he was originally cast as the Scarecrow. If people at the studio, various people that had their druthers, this is the cast you would have seen in The Wizard of Oz. Buddy Ebsen as the Scarecrow, Ray Bolger as the Tin Man, Shirley Temple as Dorothy, W.C. Fields as the Wizard, and Gail Sondergaard as a very slinky, glamorous, wicked witch with sequins. First thing that happened was that Ray Bolger, who had always wanted to play the Scarecrow, he'd seen a touring performance of the play when he was a young boy, went to L.B. Mayer and he begged him to allow him to switch roles with Buddy Ebsen and to become the Scarecrow. He said that, quite properly, he said he was a soft shoe dancer, that he was not stiff. He was a floppy dancer, and Mayer did allow this. Buddy Ebsen, who was a young dancer under contract to the studio, didn't care just so long as he was in the movie. It didn't matter to him if he was a Tin Man or if he was a Scarecrow. And so he took over the role of the Tin Man, and about 10 days into the shooting, he took a deep breath one night, and he couldn't breathe, and he was rushed to the hospital, put in an oxygen tent. He had been poisoned by his makeup. Essentially, the aluminum dust that they powdered on his face, he had inhaled and it had coated his lungs. And the studios were no more gentlemanly then than they are now, so learning that he wouldn't be available for a few weeks, they simply replaced him with Jack Haley.
There really were quite a few accidents and toxic poisoning type of incidents on The
Yes,
Wizard of
well,
Oz.
When Haley came in, A, they didn't tell him what had happened to Ebsen. Didn't really tell anybody what had happened to Ebsen. And B, they made sure they didn't powder aluminum dust on his face. What they did was they put on a white chalky material to close his pores, and then they painted over it with an aluminum paste. So he didn't have anything to breathe in. However, some of the paste got in his eye and caused a serious eye infection.
Was this pretty typical of movies with special effects at the time, that you know that actors and people working on the sound stages would end up with health problems because of the materials they were working with?
Oh, absolutely. One of the technicians who was in the special effects department told me, just with almost awe in his voice, he said, he told me how they made the breakaway glass that Bert Lahr jumped through when he jumped out of the wizard's throne room. It was a sugary material, and he said it was on a bed of mercury, a pool of mercury. And he just, even 35 years, 40 years later, he shivered. He said, we didn't know anything. We didn't know how harmful it was. We were working with mercury. We didn't know anything about it at all. When they made the cyclone, the guy who stood up on top of the stage and pushed Fuller's earth into the muslin windsock that they were using as a cyclone said that for days afterwards he was spitting up sulfur and yellow mucus. Nobody paid very much attention to safety in those days.
Elgene Harmetz recorded in 1989. Her book, The Making of the Wizard of Oz, will be republished next month. Here's a song that was recorded for the film but never used. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Did you just hear what I just heard?
That noise don't come from no ordinary bird.
It may be just a cricket or a critter in the trees.
It's given me the jitters and the joints around my knees. I think I see a jijik, and he's fuzzy and he's furry. I haven't got a brain, but I think I ought to worry.
I haven't got a heart, but I got a palpitation.
This is Monica the Forest. I don't like the situation.
Are you going to stand around and let him fill us full of horror?
I'd like to roar him down. But I think I lost my roarer.
It's a who's-us.
It's a who's-us?
It's a what's-us.
It's a what's-us?
Who's that?
Who's there?
Who's that?
Who's that? Who's that hiding in the treetops? It's that rascal, the jitterbug. Should you catch him buzzing round you, keep away from the jitterbug. Bats and the bees and the breeze and the trees have a terrible, horrible buzz. But the bats and the bees and the breeze and the trees couldn't do what the jitterbug does. So be careful of that rascal. Keep away from
the jitterbug. Oh, the jitter. Oh, the bug. Oh, the jitter.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Buck, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, theater critic John Lahr remembers his father, Bert Lahr, who played the Cowardly Lion, and Lorna Luft remembers her mother, Judy Garland. Then Lord Schwartz reviews a new Judy Garland box set, and John Powers reviews the new movie, Velvet Goldmine. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Wizard of Oz returned to movie theaters today, digitally restored and remastered. The Cowardly Lion was portrayed by Burt Lahr, a star of burlesque, vaudeville, theater, and film. His son, John Lahr, is theater critic for The New Yorker and author of a book about his father. Before we hear from John Lahr, let's listen to Burt Lahr as the Cowardly Lion.
If I were king of the forest, not queen, not duke, not prince, my regal robes of the forest would be satin, and not a cotton, and not chintz. I'd command each thing, be it fish or fowl, with a woof and a woof and a royal growl. As I'd click my heel, all the trees would kneel, and the mountains bow, and the bulls kowtow. And the sparrow would take wing. Fie, fie, were a king. Each rabbit would show respect to me, the chipmunks genuflect to me, though my tail would lash, I would show compassion for every underling. Fie, fie, were king, just king.
Each rabbit would show respect to him, the chipmunks genuflect to him,
and his wife would be queen of the May.
I'll be monarch, none all nicer way.
I spoke with Burt Lahr's son, John, in 1992.
In writing about your book, Jeffrey Wolfe said that you explore the way sadness speaks to comic genius. Do you feel you understand the connection, having written about five books about people who were professionally funny?
Well, I guess it's a mystery that I'm drawn to, because the thing that I could never quite understand about my father was how incredibly glorious he was on stage and animated, and the minute he was off, he was morose and still. And there is that's what I'm after, and that kind of curious no man's land when an ordinary citizen moves into the limelight and in front of 2,000 people and thrills them. What happens? The chemistry, the metabolism, the shift in personality. That's a sort of mystery to me that I think I understand it better than many, but I've come to no definitive conclusions, if you see what I mean.
When you were a kid in the wings watching your father and others go on stage, was there sometimes that kind of one moment of transition where they'd go from, you know, the morose backstage person to the magnetic onstage person?
Well, with an old pro like my father, he could just sort of walk on, and that connection with the audience attention brought him up. The fact that he could control them, that he was absolutely in control of them. When I was once backstage after he'd gotten a laugh on a conjunction. He'd said something like but or and the audience had fallen about. And he came off, and I said, Dad, how did you know that was funny? I mean, what told you that was funny? And he said, listen, I listened to the audience, and they told me where the joke was. And I wrote that down and didn't understand it for about 5 or 6 years until I actually got involved in the theater. And then I understood what a simple but profound thing that was, because he had such an intimate connection with an audience that he really could feel their need, and he could sort of move with them and improvise with them. And he was their kind of link to the play world. I mean, a perfectly example was in, say, Waiting for Godot, which he premiered on Broadway, I think in 1954. I might be wrong, 56. Anyway, where he sort of actually made a connection between what was then considered a very abstruse and phony play to the sort of real deep sense of loss and confusion, which he really felt and instinctively felt in the poetry of Beckett's play.
John Lahr is Burt Lahr's son and theater critic for The New Yorker. Singer and actress Lorna Luft is Judy Garland's daughter. I spoke with Luft last spring after the publication of her memoir, Me and My Shadows. She says that when her mother was signed to MGM, the studio executives decided she didn't look like a movie star and needed a makeover. Specifically, you say that the studio experts found your mother too short, too chubby, with a round spine and no neck, bad bite, nose turned up too much. Mm-hmm. Her eyes were the only thing that got a good review. What were the correctives that MGM found for your mother, Judy Garland?
Well, they would put little discs sometimes in her nose to make her nose not turn up. They did make special caps for her teeth so that they wouldn't, she had a bit of an overbite. They dyed her hair different colors. When she started to develop into being a young woman, they, of course, bound her chest. They didn't want that. They did that throughout the whole Wizard of Oz. So they basically put out this product that they thought would sell to the movie buying audience.
How old were you the first time you saw The Wizard of Oz, and what impression did it make on you?
I was about four. Actually, I was a little bit older. Maybe I was about five. And we were in our house in Holmby Hills. My brother Joe was about two. And the movie was on television, and our nanny at the time thought it would be just wonderful to make the impression on us that that was our mother. And she kept telling us that that was our mother. Now, my mom was in New York at the time, and when she realized that, of course, the movie was going to be on television, she called the house to hear two children just hysterical, crying. And she said, "What's happened? What's the matter?" And we said, "The monkeys took you to New York," and we were sobbing. And because it's a frightening movie for little kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, to be told that's your mother, well, it just scared the hell out of us. So my first time watching The Wizard of Oz wasn't exactly thrilling. But then she never let us watch it without her. And she would always sit there with us and watch it with us so that we never were frightened again.
You say that the year your mother made The Wizard of Oz was also the year she had her first, quote, nervous collapse on the publicity tour for The Wizard of Oz.
Well, look at the movie. They worked these people so hard. They didn't really, they did have child labor laws, but they weren't quite enforced. So, they worked these people so desperately hard. Because you've got to remember something. MGM was putting out a movie a week into the theaters that they owned. So, it was extraordinary the hours that people were kept at the studio and how they were, how long they had to work. So that was their main concern. Their main concern was making money.
And your mother was already a teenager when she was doing publicity for The Wizard of Oz, but she was playing much younger in the movie than she really was.
Mm-hmm.
You say she really hated having to have that more girlish image. And, I'm wondering what effect you think that had on her, playing younger in the movies than she really was.
Well, you know, she was 16. And when you're 16, that's also a very, in-between age. In fact, she sang a wonderful song called I'm Just an In-Between. And you basically, you're not an adult, yet you're not a child, but you don't quite know what you are at the age of 16. But to be told that you are not 16, or not to look 16, or not to look any older, and to be constantly, told you can't do this, you have to look like this, and you have to do, it's hard. And again, it takes a toll on your self-esteem.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lorna Luft, and she's written a new memoir called Me and My Shadows, a family memoir living with the legacy of Judy Garland. What advice did your mother give you about singing when you were young?
What she gave me about singing was basically, when she would hear me sing, she basically would never criticize me, but she would say things just very, very tenderly. Try to make this sound, she would encourage me. She would never, ever put me down or say, that's not right or whatever. I didn't realize as I've said before, that Judy Garland was giving me singing lessons. It was my mother.
Right. On one of her TV shows, she sang a song called Lorna with a lyric, I think, written by Johnny Mercer for mm-hmm. for you. How did the lyric go?
The lyric was, it's a wonderful, first the melody was written by Mort Lindsay, and it was the melody to her television show. It was the theme song to her television show. And, of course, there's never been a song called Lorna. And she was doing a segment on the show dedicated to the three of us. And, of course, you know, Liza was written by the Gershwins, and then Happiness Is Just a Thing Called Joe is a wonderful song. And then it came to my song, and there wasn't one. So she had this song especially written for me, and she never told me about it until the night of the show, and it was at the taping, and we were sitting there, and all of a sudden she asked me if I would stand up in the audience, and she came right down to the footlights, and she sang this song to me, and I was so touched. And it was just, what was really wonderful was I didn't realize where I was. I was just Mom and myself, and I was so enraptured, and I was so proud of this moment. I can't remember the audience. I don't remember cameras. I don't remember anything. I just remember that it was her and I.
Lorna Luft, her memoir is called Me and My Shadows. Coming up, Lord Schwartz reviews a new Judy Garland box set. This is Fresh Air. The re-release of The Wizard of Oz may put you in a Judy Garland kind of mood. If so, you're in luck. New Judy Garland collections are in record stores, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Hang on to rainbow, leave worry, forget to fall, and hang on to rainbow up the sky. Let worries hang go, she isn't worth the smile to see, the round of her in by. Come on and share.
That was Judy Garland in 1922 at the age of 7 from the soundtrack of a Vitaphone short. The irony of an earlier Rainbow song isn't lost on the producers of Judy, a 4-disc set with videotape and a 100-page book of photos and interviews. It was just released by 32 Records in anticipation of next year's 60th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz, and the 30th anniversary of Garland's death at 47 from an overdose of barbiturates. Rhino Records has also issued a splendid album of central Garland soundtracks called Judy Garland in Hollywood. The Judy box is filled with amazing mementos from Garland's early career. Her first commercial record, would you have guessed a swinging version of Stompin' at the Savoy? Her only known duet with Al Jolson, Over the Rainbow, on a radio show with Oscar Levant kibitzing, and a 1939 broadcast of a little dramatic recreation of Garland hearing Over the Rainbow for the first time from the people who wrote it, Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg.
Hello, Mr. Harburg. Hello, Mr. Arlen.
Hello, Judy. We've been waiting for you.
Judy, we've just finished writing one of the songs you're to sing in The Wizard of Oz. And no one's heard it yet, so we've got our fingers crossed.
Oh, I can hardly wait. Will you play it now?
Just sit you here, Judy. Lend us your ears.
You actually mean I'm going to be the first one to hear this?
That's right. But I hope you're not the last one that's going to hear it.
Now, this song is the theme of the entire picture. You're the little girl in Kansas, that unhappy little girl who's always yearning to be somewhere else but home.
Oh, but I like my home.
We don't mean your home in Bel Air, Judy. We mean the home in the picture.
Oh, you mean I'm always trying to escape from myself.
Mm-hmm. That's it, Judy. And we try to express that yearning, the yearning of all little girls in this song.
Sing it, Harold. Listen, Judy.
Somewhere
I can hardly wait to learn it. Will you teach it to me, please, now?
Has there ever been more beautiful singing than Garland doing that song in The Wizard of Oz? That velvety tone, the understated yearning, the sincerity. No pop singer was ever a better actress, and no actress a better singer. Garland was a great actress, and Hollywood knew it, though it still couldn't bring itself to give a girl singer an Oscar for acting. She was nominated twice, for her profound performance in A Star is Born, opposite James Mason in what might be his greatest role, and her poignant supporting role as the German housewife in Judgment at Nuremberg. It still makes me angry that she didn't win. I guess I fell in love with her in The Wizard of Oz. I think her gift for empathy with her characters and for the uncanny conviction of her phrasing made everyone empathize with her. Maybe no performer except Maria Callas had that capacity more. And it's fascinating to think about the connection between popular music and opera, the way both ask their performers to confide a vulnerability that no one would utter in polite company, especially, but not exclusively, about love, and to be masterful in those confessions.
The road gets rougher. It's lonelier and tougher with hope. You burn up, tomorrow he will turn up. There's just no let up, the livelong night and day. Ever since this world began, there is nothing sadder than a one-man woman looking for the man that got away.
Saying or singing the unspeakable out loud may be one reason Garland and Callas still have such a large gay contingent among their audience. The accompanying booklet of the Judy set is quite frank about this association. Yet it's hard to imagine anyone of any persuasion not giving in to the seductive but often asexual appeal of her charm. Though no one was sexier than Garland when she was being explicitly erotic. Listen to I've Got You Under My Skin, or Do It Again on her Carnegie Hall album. And no singer could be more stirring. Even with a schlocky arrangement, her rendition of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which she sang on her TV show just weeks after JFK's assassination, is one of the most powerful and moving demonstrations I know of public heroism on the grandest scale.
In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with the glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. While God is marching on.
One can't overlook the sort of sacred monster Garland turned into. Over the Rainbow became Over the Top. But these recordings show that she could transcend even her own excess. Something in that voice, that little catch, still remains irresistible.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Judy, a 4-CD set and videotape just released by 32 Records.
You're wondering, child, we'll see you when it's 20. Sure.
I'm a hungry lemon, love them all in Alabama. Mammy, Mammy, haven't done a, done a, done a, my dear old Mammy. Your wandering child will wander no more when I get to that Swanee.
Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film Velvet Goldmine. This is Fresh Air. Velvet Goldmine is the new film written and directed by Todd Haynes about the glam rock scene in London during the early 70s. Haynes' other films include Poison and Safe. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Velvet Goldmine is about the allure of surfaces, how they lie, but also how they tell the truth. It stars Jonathan Rhys-Meyers as Brian Slade, an enigmatic David Bowie-like rock god who fakes his own assassination during a 1974 concert. 10 years later, a newspaper wants a piece on whatever happened to Brian Slade, and the assignment falls to English journalist Arthur Stewart. He's played by Christian Bale. As Arthur interviews the star's old cronies, a la Citizen Kane, we see flashbacks to Slade's career, his bisexuality and drug use, his marriage to an American expat, played by Toni Collette, and his worship of an Iggy Popish rocker named Kurt Wilde, charismatically portrayed by Ewan McGregor. Yet the longer Arthur tries to find the real Brian Slade, the more we grasp that the movie is actually about Arthur's experience of the glam rock era, a utopian moment when sexual identity became fluid and people revealed who they really were by the masks they chose to wear. Like all movies by Todd Haynes, Velvet Goldmine is nothing if not audacious. Whether he's using Barbie dolls to tell the story of Karen Carpenter or exploring environmental illness, Haynes is always subverting our expectations, always looking for ways to bring the avant-garde into the multiplex. Although officially about the 70s rock scene, this new movie begins in outer space, ends in Reagan-era America, and features a cameo by the patron saint of glam rock, Oscar Wilde. A true filmmaker of ideas, Haynes uses Arthur's quest for Slade as a way to explore sexual identity, the history of gay culture, ideas of artifice, and the mechanics of pop stardom. As when Slade's manager, played by comedian Eddie Izzard, explains how you become a pop idol.
That man sitting over there in the white suit is the biggest thing that come out of this country since Sly Beetle. Outside this country, no one knows who the hell he is. You people, you're gonna change all that. You guys, you're the actors. It's up to you to change Brian Slade, pop singer, in a Maxwell Demon space age f***ing superstar. Nothing fantastic about it. Why? Because the secret of becoming a star is knowing how to behave like one.
While Velvet Goldmine is the year's brainiest picture, what grabs you first is its sheer joy and spectacle. Haynes clearly adores glam rock's flamboyance, and he uses his movie to celebrate 70s high style. He gives us platform shoes and faces painted with glitter. He gives us hairdos the color of Fruit Loops and silvery costumes that sprout iridescent plumage. He gives us men dressed as women, women dressed as men, and musical numbers so deliriously gaudy, they're like a Hello Dolly revival in Oz. But while the movie's always a joy to watch, the story itself is often cold and abstract, too aware of its intellectual meaning. Haynes never takes us inside his character's juicy passions. The camera lingers on Rhys-Meyers' pouting beauty as Slade, But we never feel the singer's excitement as he seduces the crowd or slides into bed with whoever suits him. We understand how glam helped the journalist Arthur to discover his gayness, but we don't share his quivering thrill as he sees his own forbidden longings enacted on stage. Nor does the movie capture rock and roll's visceral power. Although handsomely mounted, the musical sequences are so studied that I began longing for the bacchanalian energy that Oliver Stone brought to the Doors. Such primal excitement happens here only once, when Kurt Wilde tears off his trousers and dives through flames into the roaring crowd. For all its intellectualism, Velvet Goldmine is about the liberating power of pop culture. It shows how a movement like glam rock can tear through suffocating traditions and offer its fans a doorway to new ways of living. Haynes would clearly like his movie to do the same thing for today's moviegoers. This is a lofty goal, and it leads him to cram too many ideas into a single film. He introduces a key character, a dandyish clubber named Jack Ferry, then drops him. He mimics the structure of Citizen Kane, but doesn't deliver a rosebud. He stages so many MTV-ish numbers that eventually swamp the story. But while these flaws drag down the film's second hour, they're a side effect of a willingness to take huge artistic risks. Velvet Goldmine is too ambitious for its own good. But in a week where they're re-releasing The Big Chill as a classic, I won't fault Todd Haynes for aiming too high.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our show was produced today by Roberta Shurrock with Kathy Wolf. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Bob Purdick is our engineer. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Little Brown & Company, publisher of The Thinker's Way, 8 Steps to a Richer Life by John Chaffee, Ph.D., in bookstores. And the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. This is NPR, National Public Radio.